This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 16 of Here's How. In this podcast, I have an extended, exclusive interview with Jamie Bryson, the loyalist blogger who has broken much of the story of the NAMA Project Eagle scandal.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
Volkswagen, after more than a year of saying that inaccurate emissions claims about their diesel cars in the United States were caused by a glitch, finally fessed up, but only after they were caught red-handed. They admitted that they had deliberately developed a sophisticated system which detected when a car was in an emissions test in something like the equivalent of the NCT. The detection system was in the software that controls the engine of the car, and it really was sophisticated. It monitored various inputs like the driving pattern, like how the car was being steered. When this software system detected that the car was being tested, not being driven normally, it would put the car in a mode that would meet all the emissions standards. And the standards in the US are stricter than in Europe. When the vehicle was being driven normally, the mode was changed, giving the car much better performance, particularly in acceleration, but also in fuel economy. But the emissions performance would be worse, much, much worse. In the case of some of the most dangerous emissions, nitrous oxides, the car in its normal driving mode would emit 40 times, 40, 40 times the legal limit. There are contradictory estimates out there, and of course you can't say that any one person died because of the emissions of one particular car, even one brand of car, but all of the estimates for the excess number of deaths caused by these excess emissions are in the many thousands. Needless to say, VW are in deep trouble over this. Already two of their other brands, Audi and the Czech brand Škoda, have been confirmed as doing the same thing. Switzerland has temporarily banned the sales of the cars affected. VW have confirmed that they were pulling the same trick in Europe. The US could, theoretically, fine VW up to $36,000 for each car fitted with the device, and there were millions of cars. The CEO of Volkswagen has resigned, and German prosecutors have opened a file on him with a view to putting him on trial. Make no mistake, this is an existential threat to the VW Group. They could go out of business. They won't now be able to sell cars with this test-cheating software, and they won't be able to sell cars without it either, because they don't remotely meet the emissions standards that are required in most parts of the world. Before the story broke, VW were quietly recalling cars, telling customers that they needed to do a minor service, and then changing the software so that the cars would meet the emission standards in normal driving. It's going to be hard to persuade all the other VW drivers, and now Audi and Škoda drivers too, to show up for a service that will significantly reduce their fuel economy and the driving performance of their cars. It's going to be just as hard to sell new cars like that. VW are going to have to very quickly develop new engines that meet the promises that they've been making about emissions and performance. That development process normally takes many years. What are they going to sell in the meantime? Now, this is being done to death in most of the media, and I don't want to rehash all of that, but there are a couple of points that I think are being missed. The first point is the claim that this may be the operation of some rogue manager or small division within VW, and that the people at the top are unfortunate fall guys who were let down by staff further down the ladder. Anyone who knows anything about software development knows that this project, developing the software to cheat the emissions tests, was a major effort. it would require a team to cooperate with different departments responsible for developing steering, engines, and other software teams. VW has a staff of 600,000. It's not a matter of just dropping around to the other guy's cubicle. You'd need to schedule meetings, do business plans, presentations to other departments. You'd need a development budget. And the software would have required extensive testing, with VW staff going out and making sure that it reduced the emissions when, and only when, it was being tested in a garage. VW uses an enterprise software system called SAP to run its business. Many Irish people will be familiar with using it in their workplace. It tracks the cost of all the resources needed to produce each car, controlling payments and staff scheduling and many other things. And this project would have to be tracked in SAP, so there's no chance it could have been done without a proper authorization number. Also, this scandal is bad for Germany in particular, but policing big car firms like this is supposed to be done by the EU, and they totally missed it. We found out about it because VW got caught in the US. Although the Americans shouldn't be too proud either, they only caught it because scientists from West Virginia University managed to win a funding grant to test cars in real-world conditions, and the Volkswagens failed horribly. And that happened more than a year ago. The two studies were published in May and October of 2014. It's taken until now for the US EPA to realise their significance. One big question that nobody is answering is, what are other car manufacturers up to? We don't know if they're up to the same tricks or similar ones, but there is evidence that they're up to no good. I contacted Professor Alistair Lewis of Wolfson Atmospheric Chemistry Laboratories at the University of York, who's an expert in this area. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to come on the podcast, but he did point me to one study, and I'll link to it on the webpage for this podcast. And what the study did was fairly simple. It takes the declared emissions from all the vehicles being driven in London, the study was done for London, and then it compared those declarations to the actual emissions that could be detected in the air. And they discovered that there's a huge disparity. The air contains almost double the toxic gases that were reported in the emissions of the vehicles that are actually on the roads. And this is serious. Professor Martin Williams of King's College London estimates that in the UK alone, there are 5,800 premature deaths directly attributable to diesel fumes, and between 50 and 80% of those deaths are caused by the portion of the emissions that are above the legal limits. The other people that this is bad for are the anti-regulation fundamentalists. I'm not a big fan of intrusive regulation myself. Where customers can make decisions for themselves, then that seems the best option. But this scandal proves that huge multinationals with large workforces are capable of undertaking enormous criminal conspiracies and making them successful and keeping them secret and causing harm to their customers and to society. Individual customers could never have the resources to detect, let alone defend themselves from a crime like this. There are some fans of Austrian economists like Hayek and Mises who reject the notion of regulation altogether. Their solution is common law injury lawsuits. So in this case, every member of society would have had to individually sue every VW owner, and every VW owner would have to individually sue Volkswagen. That's not very realistic. The EU has a history of constantly extending its authority. It's time that they got better at doing the job they're supposed to be doing.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
On a Skype line from Belfast now, I'm joined by Jamie Bryson. Jamie Bryson is a loyalist blogger. He is also an anti-agreement activist. Jamie, you've changed tack a little bit and you're investigating in the NAMA affair with Project Eagle in Northern Ireland. First of all, just for people who are not so familiar with it, why is this showing up in Northern Ireland news?
Well, there was an allegation made in the Doyle initially by Mick Wallace, an independent TD, who alleged that a politician in Northern Ireland was set to receive a portion of around 7.5 million that was deposited into an offshore account.
So how was this money discovered? Where did this where was this money coming from?
Well, initially the money was a managing partner with Intunes, a gentleman called Mr. Lane Coulter. The money was paid into a dormant Danske Bank account. Intunes currently bank with Ulster Bank. So this account had been dormant for quite some time.
I should say that Tuans is the law firm that's used by Cerberus. Cerberus is the firm that bought the entire NAMA property portfolio in Northern Ireland. They paid something in the region of 1.1 billion for property with a book value of something like 4.5 billion euro. Tuans, their lawyers, their law firm in the United States was Brown Rudnick. Tuans were the subcontracted law firm that they used in Northern Ireland, and Ian Coulter was a lawyer with Tuans, but he left under strange circumstances.
Yes, that's correct. And just coincidentally, after Mr. Coulter left, 2 weeks later, he formed his own company. As part of my evidence session on Wednesday, I don't want to stray too far off, but just to give a bit of a background, I went into an issue around another site connected to NAMA. It's called the Millmount site. It's in a place called Dundonald, not far outside Belfast. And the beneficiaries of a bit of a change of heart in relation to NAMA of that site was a group called the Lagan Company, who employ the First Minister's son, Mr. Gareth Robinson, as a lobbyist. But coincidentally, after Mr. Coulter left Tunes, he not only set up his own company, but he very quickly became a director, a shareholder, in five companies belonging to the Lagan Group.
And the process of this money being found, which is not now, it's not known where it is, but that money, do we know where it came from originally?
Well, the money was deposited into the Danske Bank account.
Of Tuan's lawyers?
Yes, but it was a dormant account. So the other managing partners, we'll have to be clear, my information was that they knew nothing about this whatsoever. It was only Mr. Coulter. And from the dormant Danske Bank account, the money was then transferred into an offshore account in the Isle of Man.
That account was under the exclusive control of Ian Coulter?
That's my understanding, yes. How it was discovered was that Ian Coulter had to enlist the assistance of a junior, I suppose, for this financial transaction. Now, we have to remember that Ian Coulter was a very well-respected lawyer.
So he gets an assistant to do the transaction for him?
Yes, and which wouldn't have been out of the ordinary, you know, for an assistant who's asked to do something or you know, further than that, a junior within the bank. When somebody's asked to do something, somebody with the credibility of Mr. Coulter, you know, wouldn't think twice or wouldn't think to question it. But what then transpired was that the Law Society were carrying out just an ordinary audit. They hadn't found the money, but the junior person involved panicked, believed that he may have been caught up in some wrongdoing, and he went and flagged this up to the other managing partners in Tunes. And it was at that point there's some dispute over between Mr. Coulter and Tunes. Their statements are quite conflicting as to what actually happened, but the result was Mr. Coulter resigned from Tunes at that point, and has then went on to form a remarkable relationship with the Lagan Group.
And the Lagan Group, just to be clear, what is their connection?
Well, the Lagan Group, initially, when NAMA took over the loans, there was the Millmount site in Dundonald. NAMA's preference was to sell that site. They didn't think that it was a good financial move to continue on with the development agreement that had been drawn up between the Anglo-Irish Bank and Lagans were to be the developers. Just to take you back to give a
so Ian Coulter left Tuan Solicitors, and he then became very closely associated with a development group that was essentially in NAMA, who owed their loans to NAMA.
Well, what had happened was the Millmount site was originally owned by companies controlled by two gentlemen called Noel Murphy and Adam Armstrong. They sold the site on to the Taggart Builders, for a value of approximately $96 million in 2007. But this is where it starts to get interesting, because at that stage, this transaction was financed through the Anglo-Irish Bank, and they approved this massive loan to the Taggart Brothers whilst the company were in serious financial difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And within, you know, a short period of time, in 2008, Anglo then themselves placed the Taggart Brothers in the administration. So they eventually financed the company that was heading to the wall to purchase the Millmount site. And after the site was placed under control of an administrator of the Anglo-Irish Bank, they came to an agreement which would have resulted in Lagan Homes developing the site. Now, Lagan Homes is owned by a man called Mr. Kevin Lagan. And Mr. Lagan is involved in joint business ventures, such as Lagmar Properties, with Mr. Noel Murphy, who was the original owner. So Mr. Murphy was one of the individuals who directly benefited from this strange decision by the Anglo-Irish Bank to fund Taggart's purchase of the Millmount Bank, the Millmount site. And then, once the site was placed in the administration, Lagan's, Mr. Murphy's business partners, were to benefit from a lucrative development contract. That fell through when the loans went from into NAMA.
But if that had gone through, Murphy would have been essentially perhaps not on both sides of the deal, but very close to both sides of the deal.
Absolutely, yes, yes. When NAMA was initially set up, their preferred option was to sell the site.
They reckoned the deal wasn't a good one.
Well, they scrapped the deal that had been drawn up between the Anglo-Irish Bank, the Millmount administrators and the Lagan Group that they wanted to sell the site. At that stage, the DUP had issued numerous statements warning against a fire sale. They expressed concerns over how NAMA would handle the Northern Ireland loan portfolio. It was in this regard that Sammy Wilson, he would at the time have been in the Northern Ireland Assembly Finance Minister, a member of the Democratic Unionist Party, and Gareth Robinson, he is the son of the First Minister and was a councillor of the DUP. He was lobbying on behalf of the Lagan Group. And at this stage, Mr. Sammy Wilson then undertook numerous lobbying of NAMA for the site. Now, it's open to interpretation and it's up for people to make their own mind whether that was, you know, a crossover of abusing political influence or using political influence to try and get a deal for your constituents. You know, again, that's a matter for people to make their own mind up. But what eventually happened was that NAMA, after their initial assessment that they wanted to sell the site and scrapping the original deal, they then released £9 million in April 2013 to develop the site, and the beneficiaries were to be the Lagan Group, who, of course, has the First Minister's son as a lobbyist. So quite why this change of heart took place has not yet been established.
Okay. And to get back to the issue at hand, the core issue of the sale of the whole of the Northern Ireland portfolio to Cerberus,
yes.
That was done using the law firm Tuins, because Brown Rudnick, the US law firm of Cerberus, didn't have a presence in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. So contracted.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that legal work was essentially subcontracted to Tuins. How then did the idea of money in the Isle of Man, £7.5 million sterling in the Isle of Man, being earmarked for certain people in Northern Ireland, how did that happen?
Well, these individuals have been working hand in glove for quite some time. I assume that they saw some financial benefit, but you have to remember that whenever, before the sale of Project Eagle, Peter Robinson sent a memorandum of understanding to NAMA that was described by Mr. Frank Daly, the chairperson of NAMA, as a debtor's charter. He said NAMA would never have touched it. He was bemused as the, I'm paraphrasing him at this stage, but he essentially said that he was confused and bemused as to why the First Minister would send this memorandum of understanding. He thought it was a debtor's charter and there's no way NAMA would have agreed to it. He essentially binned it. But the proposals within that memorandum of understanding seem to echo how Cerberus have treated a particular number of property developers who are close to the First Minister, Mr. Peter Robinson, which again, you know, there's a serious questions as to around what backdoor deal essentially has been made between Cerberus and the First Minister. We know, of course, that Cerberus, Mr. Dan Quayle, the former Vice President of the United States, held a meeting with Mr. Peter Robinson only a number of just over the week before the eventual purchase of Project Eagle. Sinn Féin, that's the way the Northern Ireland Assembly works, is it's a joint ministry. Sinn Féin and OFM-DFM deny that they were aware of this meeting.
OFM-DFM is the Office of the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister.
Yeah, and essentially that it's a joint office, and they should, everything has to be put in the diary and so on. This was, Sinn Féin contained, a secret meeting. It was not publicised, and you know, to think that...
Peter Robinson as First Minister was in on it, Martin McGuinness as Deputy First Minister should have been and wasn't.
Yes, and also present at the meeting was Ian Coulter, the man who, of course, transferred the money into the offshore account. So there's no minutes of this meeting or no...
What is the relevance of Dan Quayle? Why was he involved?
Well, Dan Quayle is a senior member of Cerberus.
So he's employed now by Cerberus, the former vice president of the US?
He is, yes.
Okay. And as far as you're concerned, the money that caused Ian Coulter, or that was associated with Ian Coulter leaving Tuhans in the first place, who was that for?
Well, the five individuals I named before the Finance Committee was Mr. Peter Robinson, MLA, Mr. Thank Cushnahan, and of course we know through the initial testimony, I think it was on the 9th of July, by Mr. Thank Daly, to the PAC Committee, that Mr. Cushnahan was to benefit from $5 million from the PIMCO deal, which eventually fell through.
Frank Cushnahan is a Northern Ireland businessman.
Yes, he'd be a businessman, yes. David Waters, who is a chartered accountant, and a property developer called Mr. Andrew Crichton. Mr. Crichton actually has loans in NAMA. And Mr. Waters, companies connected to Mr. Waters, were actually on an advisory group to NAMA as to how they dealt with property developers within Northern Ireland, whilst other companies connected to him had loans within NAMA.
And Ian Coulter, the lawyer himself, I think you said was the fifth person who was supposed to be...
Yes, Ian Coulter, he was the bagman, the user, code for this.
But according to the testimony that you've given, he was going to be entitled to some of the loot in the bag.
Yes.
Okay. I have to put it to you, Jamie, you're an anti-agreement unionist, loyalist. You have obviously a beef with the DUP and Peter Robinson in particular because they've gone into joint government. You also have a criminal conviction in relation to disorder with the flag protests. Wouldn't Peter Robinson say to you, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? It's easy for you to throw mud.
Well, yeah, I just ask people to make their own minds up. I've provided the information and it's up to them. And I should say that the conviction in relation to the union flag protests was not a conviction connected to disorder. It was for what essentially amounts to jaywalking. So just to place that on the record, there was no convictions of being involved in any disorder or violence whatsoever. And the judge actually acknowledged that I had not been involved and had actually used any influence, which I may have been perceived to have, to ensure that protests remain peaceful and within the law. And the judge accepted that. So I should just place that on the record.
That's fair enough.
But yeah, it's a matter for Peter Robinson, but it's a matter essentially for the public to make their own mind up and the experts to look into this. I'm providing the information. I believe it's factual information. I can stand over the information, and I have made these allegations, as I promised I would, outside of the committee.
Well, that's right, I was reading your Twitter feed. Yeah. You were essentially goading them to sue you.
Yeah, well, I have made these allegations without privilege, and if they are so certain, why is there not legal letters falling through my door? Why am I not being sued? So I welcome any legal action that they would take, because I think it then will provide an opportunity to really get to the bottom of this. And the ironic thing is that if one of these individuals was to take legal action, then it would essentially draw them all in, because, of course, they're all party to this allegation. So they would all be liable to be brought forward, questioned, character, cross-examined on their character. We could request discovery of all communications between these individuals and other things. So it would be make for a very interesting court case, which is perhaps why they haven't initiated legal action.
And to be clear, all of the people who you've mentioned, not one of them has threatened you legally? No,
there's been no legal threats made to me directly. When I initially published an initial blog in early July, I think I published a blog at 10:45 in the evening, and by midnight the Democratic Unionist Party had issued a blanket threat to all media outlets, that if anybody referenced the blog, anybody linked to it, or even mentioned the existence of it, that they would be subject to legal action, which the DUP would be initiating the next morning. And I think that's almost 4 months ago, and as yet no legal action they have initiated. This is the DUP for so long, and I think this is I think Newton Emerson, who would be a columnist with the Irish News, raised this issue the other day, is whereby the situation that has arisen with me has essentially bypassed libel laws and identified a loop in the libel laws, which is a very, you know, interesting debate which has come out of this and has been raised by a number of commentators, whereby quite often people such as the DUP and these powerful businessmen thought the threat of legal action was enough to send people running into the cupboard. And that's how things were, in my mind, covered up for so long, some of these dodgy deals, and how they became so confident and got away with what they could get away with was because they thought a mere letter from a solicitor with a high profile such as Mr. Paul Tweed, and people would be hiding under the bed. And I think when it comes to me and when it comes to Mick Wallace, they've come up against two people who has essentially said, you know, we don't care about Paul Tweed. We don't care about the legal letters. Go ahead.
That may be the case. Listen, Jamie, I want to ask just on the ground, do you have any specific examples of how this influence is working, of how people who are developers or any other people are being treated by Cerberus?
Absolutely. You know, an example I gave the other day, and I think I'll give the example again, of an individual, Mr. Paddy Kearney. His companies would have been a company called PBN and Kimona Holdings Limited. You know, these are his accounts. Anybody can go and get a hold of them and look at them themselves to confirm what I am saying. But, you know, in the Mr. Kearney's accounts for the year to 30th of June 14 showed a loss of $216 million. This was one of the biggest losses ever recorded by Northern Ireland Company. And the company also had a shareholders deficit of $223 million. Therefore, essentially was trading unlawfully. And, you know, as I pointed out the other day, the auditors couldn't really stand over the accounts.
When you're saying this, that the company appeared to be insolvent and it's a duty of a director to liquidate the company, essentially, if that's the case.
It appeared so, and that's certainly what the accounts would reflect. But on June 30th, the company actually owed the banks, sorry, this is June 30th, 2014, the company owed the banks $334 million. Now, in the majority of cases, the borrowers, which at this time was Cerberus, would have appointed an administrator.
You know, the lenders, you mean?
Yes, sorry, the lenders. Would have appointed an administrator and sell the assets and you know, pay the proceeds to the banks and
get back whatever money you can.
Yeah, yeah. But Cerberus took a remarkably different view in relation to Mr. Kearney and loaded off in excess of $224 million, which meant that the company only had to repay the lender in and around a figure of $110 million. And, you know, when the audited accounts will, you know, back this up. So this can then be contrasted with companies such as Mr. Gareth Graham, whose loans were always paid on time. And I don't want to stray too far into Mr. Graham as an example because he has an ongoing civil case in relation, and I wouldn't want to prejudice that. But, you know, I can also point out...
Well, what was Mr. Graham's position? Was he as badly off as Paddy Kearney?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, Mr. Graham... He alleges and he has said that he had never missed a loan repayment. His companies were in good financial shape and essentially Cerberus just come in and wiped him out. But if we look at how Mr. Kearney was treated...
Well, no, when you say wiped him out, what was the mechanism of that?
Well, I think they looked... now, I'd have to go back and check a transcript for Mr. Graham's evidence, but I think they requested $30 million and then around that figure to be provided within 24 to 48 hours, and they basically just made the situation unworkable for the man.
So they basically called in the loan, said you have to pay off the whole thing instantly.
Yeah, and you know, again, be worth checking with Mr. Graham, give testimony to the finance committee, so all the exact figures, I am only paraphrasing from memory, the figures at Mr. Graham, so you know, don't take them precise figures as read, it would be
better. I understand.
Yeah, delete the transcript. But Mr. Kearney's loans were refinanced through a company called Jeffrey's Loans Corp.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another company called Mr. John Muscally. He owned 10 Square Hotel and other places. And They stated in the statement of administrators for Mr. Muscali, they stated that the company was unable to meet its debts. Mr. Muscali only had debts of $3 million. And when we contrast this $3 million vis-a-vis $334 million,
mm-hmm.
it's quite remarkable.
And do you have any evidence that of the reason as to why Paddy Kearney might have got preferable treatment?
Well, I believe Mr. Kearney got preferable treatment due to his relationship with the First Minister, Mr. Peter Robinson, and a backroom deal that was done by Cerberus. And I believe the treatment of Mr. Kearney echoes proposals that were put into that memorandum of understanding that Mr. Robinson sent to NAMO, which was ultimately discarded by NAMO. But just one point which is very interesting, that how Mr. Muscali has been made to suffer with his $3 million of debts, you know, vis-a-vis $334 million of Paddy Kearney. The mm-hmm. beneficiary of this treatment of Mr. Muscali is going to be Mr. Paddy Kearney.
How is that?
Well, Mr. Kearney has now been selected as the purchaser for not only Mr. Muscali's 10 square hotel, but all of Mr. Muscali's assets.
So essentially what's happening is that Cerberus have buckled down on Muscali, forced him to sell up or taken back his properties, and Paddy Kearney is the preferred buyer from the liquidators, essentially controlled by Cerberus. Is that correct?
Yes. Ernst and Young, they were appointed by Plumatoria Legal on the 20th of January 2015.
And you say that Paddy Kearney is politically linked to Peter Robinson. Do you have any evidence of that?
Well, whenever Mr. Kearney benefited from this, which I would term sweetheart loan deal, quite a remarkable deal, which had his debts wrote off, there was a celebration, a secret celebration dinner in a hotel in Carrickfergus, which Mr. Kearney, and the primary guest was Mr. Peter Robinson, MLA, and the dinner was organised by a gentleman called Mr. Alan Maines. He is a former RUC and British intelligence officer who has acted as a go-between between these property developers, such as Mr. Kearney and others, including the Lagans, who we alluded to earlier, and Jeffrey's Loan Corps, and Cerberus. And Mr. Maines is linked to Cerberus through an individual who is the main man in dealing with this for Cerberus, is a gentleman called Mr. Ronald O'Coggle. And he is a former British intelligence officer and who knows Mr. Maines from their times in the security services. So they have been working together to essentially facilitate these sweetheart deals for a select number, a charmed circle, suppose, of property developers.
Jamie Bryson, loyalist blogger and investigator into NAMA's affairs in Northern Ireland, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you, William.
If you like the Here's How podcast, please rate and review the show on iTunes and other podcast providers. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Tell your friends. But most of all, make your views heard. Call us on 076-603-5060.
So after I interviewed Jamie Bryson, some curious things happened. He's been writing about this affair on his blog for some time, and the traditional media have been reluctant to print a lot of what he's been saying, not least because of legal threats from various people involved. But bit by bit, much of what he said was later confirmed, often by the BBC. Bryson had spoken as a witness to the Stormont Finance Committee inquiry into the NAMA controversy on Wednesday the 23rd of September. Almost immediately, Shane Ross, who is a member of the Dáil Public Accounts Committee, said in public that they too should hear from him. Bryson tells me that he then got an email from John McGuinness, the PAC chairman, seemingly direct from John McGuinness's iPhone, suggesting that he should come, and Bryson agreed. Bryson also says that McGuinness told him that he had asked the clerk of the PAC to arrange this, and the clerk refused, which seems very peculiar. And now it seems that Bryson has been uninvited to appear before the PAC, although he clearly has a lot to say, and Bryson may travel to Dublin in an effort to have his say anyway. So that's almost the end of episode 16 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 29th of September, 2015. References for everything that I mention in the show are listed in this episode's page on the hereshow.ie website. If you can think of a topic or want to suggest someone to include, and that could be you, then let me know. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and write a nice review. Also, please like the show on Facebook, please follow @HeresHowPodcast on Twitter, and of course, subscribe to the show. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. You can do all of that or get in touch with the show right from www.hereshow.ie. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.